and trying his best to cheer up his friend, by juggling, of all things. I can still see Rob sitting there, slumped in his chair, hands in his pockets, furry hood over his head, and that little dark, rainy cloud hovering above him. And then something miraculous happened. A huge smile began to slowly spread across his face as he became entranced by the simple phenomenon of three bean-filled sacks flying in a circle. The little, dark cloud began to melt away. "We good now?" Andy said, while continuing to juggle. Rob merely nodded, and the next thing I heard was that laugh, that deep, booming laugh that carried across the peaks as they shared a joke. That was the type of friendship these guys had. You didn't have to push the right button often with Rob, but when circumstances dictated, Andy knew exactly which one to push. I don't mean to convey a false impression that Rob is a guy who thought that every day was sunshine and rainbows, and I don't doubt that he endured some anxious, pressure-filled moments that I was not privy to. In fact, one of the true managerial genius-like qualities of a director is to shield his cast from those moments, and to hide their own insecurities if they have any. In other words, to keep some of their cards hidden, as Rob might put it, being a fan of poker metaphors. As a longtime thespian himself, Rob has a genuine affection for his fellow actors, and, having grown up on sets, has a great deal of empathy for the filmmaking process. He is also very decisive, which is a very good thing in a director with a vision. The only other thing that neither he nor Andy cared much for besides the weather in the UK was, as I have already said, the food. And having grown up in England, I can tell you that traditional British fare has never been anything to write home about. Today, TV chefs may have ushered in a new age of cuisine in the UK, and indeed throughout the world, but to an outsider at that time, especially in the hinterlands of Great Britain, it must have seemed like a veritable culinary wasteland.
Andy Scheinman.
We were out there in a foreign world making a movie. We were cut off from the real world, especially up in Sheffield. I remember walking in on the first day and asking the guy at the hotel, "What's the best restaurant in Sheffield?" And he says, "We don't have one."
It's not so much that the food was bad. It was mostly just bland and unadventurous. So, being decisive as he was, Rob opted to take the matter into his own hands and ordered a hibachi grill to be installed in his suite at the Hallam Tower Hotel. At the end of each day, he would invite us all to gather in his suite for hamburgers and hot dogs. It was great fun, with Chris, Rob, and Mandy crooning harmonies to Rob's favorite doo-wop songs as he flipped burgers on the grill. Although these parties involved a beer or some wine, they never went on too late, as we had early call times the next day.
Chris Sarandon.
We were on location together for the first 6 or 8 weeks, and we were all in the same hotel, which doesn't often happen. It was like being at a great summer camp. We ate together, if not in the hotel dining room, then in Rob's suite. We would sit around and eat and sing, play games. It was just a great experience.
Robin Wright.
So we would have these dinners about 4 nights a week in Rob's room, all of us, together, because we didn't know anybody else, and we were out in the middle of nowhere. Anyway, after a couple of bottles of wine, he, Chris Guest, and Mandy would always break into harmonizing old standards, and we would all join in, and it was a sing-fest. It was the greatest.
One night, right after we had all gone to bed, the fire alarm went off in the hotel. Loud, noisy, high-pitched sirens. The kind you couldn't speak over, they were so deafening. Security personnel began to immediately clear the rooms, sending all of the hotel's occupants out into the street. We all stood there in the cold night air, in our pajamas, nightgowns, and robes, while the local firemen, who had just arrived, made sure that the building was safe before letting us return to our rooms. We all sort of milled around, occasionally making eye contact with one another, wondering which one of us was responsible for the mayhem. We figured it had to be someone from our crew, since we had basically taken over the entire hotel. No one ever officially owned up to it, and I suppose it might have been someone sneaking a cigarette in bed that triggered the alarm. But that seems unlikely, as it ended up happening 2 or 3 more times. For a long time, I was convinced that Rob's hibachi may have been responsible, and that he must have left it on by mistake. When I asked him later about it, he denied it with a smile, and said he thought it was Andre, who also had a hibachi in his room, claiming that after eating the hotel out of all their food for that day, he was always still hungry in the middle of the night. which is an image itself. Sadly, Andre is no longer around to defend himself, so I guess we'll never know who the culprit was. Besides turning Rob into the crew cook, England had also somehow transformed him into a big darts fan. Not long after he arrived, he bought a dartboard and had it set up in his suite at the Dorchester Hotel, where he and Andy eventually had to redecorate the wall from all the times they completely missed. He even brought it with him to Derbyshire. Strangest of all, he'd also become a fan of sheepdog trials, which were on television almost as often as the darts competitions in Sheffield. He was amused that these two shows seemed to dominate the British TV schedule. I remember walking into his room one night, and there was Rob, transfixed by the trials.
"Gary, come here. Check this out," he said, giddy as a schoolboy. "This has to be the craziest sport ever."
"What is?" I asked. Rob then nodded to the TV.
"Look, the idea is that each dog rounds up these 8 or 9 sheep and herds them into a little paddock, right?"
I nodded, "yes."
"And each farmer that owns a dog in the competition uses his whistle to make the dog herd the sheep into the paddock, and the fastest dog to get him in there wins, right?"
"Right," I said, smiling at Rob's amusement. "So?"
"So how dumb do these sheep have to be?" he exclaimed, gesturing at the TV. "I mean, after the 26th dog, they're still confused about where they should be herded."
He was right. It was pretty funny, but that didn't stop him from watching the show start to finish. Chapter 8. True Love. I didn't know much about Robin before The Princess Bride. I wasn't even familiar with her work on Santa Barbara, so I didn't know what to expect when I met her. I'm sure she knew nothing about me either. I was only marginally more experienced than she was, and certainly not as popular, as daytime fans tend to be fervently loyal. I found myself thinking, wow, she can act, she's funny, and she's beautiful. What's wrong with this girl? Well, truth be told, there wasn't a thing wrong. Even her British accent was flawless, which is not nearly as simple an achievement as you might think. I've spent a considerable amount of time in America, and listen to many Americans try to affect a British accent, and it's not easy. But Robin has a great ear, and like myself, Billy, and Chris Guest, she loved to imitate accents. Not maliciously, but in a fun sort of way. And in doing so, make a study of that dialect. I've always been that way as well. Whenever I hear an interesting accent, I feel an urge to make a study of it too, which I guess goes back to my father, who was an incredible mimic, and to my love for Peter Sellers, who may have been one of the greatest connoisseurs of dialects of all time. From his very first role playing an East End thug in The Ladykillers and all the varied roles in Dr. Strangelove to his flawless yet wonderfully absurd French accent portraying Inspector Clouseau in the Pink Panther series, he switched something on in my brain as a kid. So naturally, when Robin and I arrived in Sheffield and heard that the folks from the Midlands had a very distinct vernacular, we would find ourselves trying to finesse the sound. As we were both Python and Fawlty Towers fans, we would watch their movies and shows on VHS whenever we had some downtime in our trailers. And it was during that time that I also turned Robin onto my favorite Python, Michael Palin, and one of his shows called Ripping Yarns. In return, she and Andy introduced me to SCTV, which I had never seen. Andy arranged for his office to have the whole series recorded, transferred from NTSC to PAL, the local format, and shipped to us on VHS on location. Sheffield is also, incidentally, the birthplace of Palin. I am such a fan of his that when Rob asked me for suggestions of English comic actors to play the impressive clergyman, Palin was my first suggestion. It turned out that even though he loved the script, he sadly had to decline, as he was about to play a character afflicted with one of the most notorious speech impediments ever put on film, Ken Pyle in A Fish Called Wanda. Rob then mentioned that Peter Cook had also been suggested for the role and asked me about him, as he was not familiar with his work. I told him we should get Peter right away before he changed his mind, as he was part of one of the most celebrated British comic duos when he partnered with Dudley Moore in the 60s. We were lucky to get Peter, as he was flawless in the role of the clergyman with a flawed accent. Looking back, I think Robin's performance in The Princess Bride is vastly underrated. Her role was to play the victim, the titular Princess Bride, a young woman who goes through a lot of trauma having lost her true love, but has to essentially look beautiful in the process. Here is another description of her from the book. Buttercup doesn't care much about clothes, and she hates brushing her long hair, so she isn't as attractive as she might be, but she's still probably the most beautiful woman in the world. That was Robin's job, to look like a woman who would inspire a young farmhand to leave home and set off in search of wealth and security so that he might one day be worthy of her hand in marriage. Sounds easy enough, right? Most people think if you're blessed with the right bone structure or if you just let the makeup and lighting crew do their work, all you have to do is bat your eyes at the camera and your job is done with a role like that. Not quite. Buttercup falls in love, loses her love, gets kidnapped, is forced into an arranged marriage, reconnects with her one true love, and then lets him go in order to save his life. It really requires a great deal of emotional range. What it doesn't require, or at least doesn't display, is the comedic talent for which The Princess Bride is so well known. Goldman wrote a screenplay that we now know is filled with great classic funny lines. Unfortunately, few, if any, of those lines are given to Buttercup. Robin is not merely the victim in the film, she's also the straight man, or in this case, the straight woman. And even though Wesley is not exactly a comedian, he does have some funny lines, and is involved in some rather broad physical comedy. Robin's character is permitted no such relief. From start to finish, she had to play it straight, exactly as the role demanded.
Christopher Guest.
Robin was very young. She must have been in her early 20s, and she was astoundingly beautiful. And she was incredibly sweet as well. She did a wonderful accent, which is very hard for most Americans to do. And Carrie was this handsome guy, and he had a great sense of humor. Fortunately, the script is not just some straight part. It has all these twists and turns, and it has great lines, obviously. So it wasn't a one-dimensional sort of young hero part. It had a lot of other angles to it. It was much more nuanced than you would find in a conventional script. So here are these two people, and they're surrounded by crazy people, basically. There are these two evil people, myself and Chris Sarandon, and Mandy is this out-of-control sort of guy who's out to get revenge, and then there are some other oddities. But there's a spine of sorts, and Carrie and Robin have to be kind of regular people, and that's always much harder to do than to be the bad guy. It's just a dream to play the guy in the torture chamber because, well, it's a dream.
That kind of professionalism, I have since discovered, is more apt to be found in actors who have honed their craft on the stage or in television, as opposed to movies. This is especially true of daytime television. I remember one time when Robin and I were looking at the call sheet together after a day's shoot, and I couldn't believe the sheer volume of work we faced in the morning and the pages of dialogue we would have to learn. And Robin just shrugged. To her, it was no big deal. On Santa Barbara, she had to routinely bite off vast chunks of dialogue with virtually no time to memorize or rehearse. In fact, we were all kind of blown away by her steadfastness and professionalism, how she never dropped her character or her accent while the camera was rolling. Since her role is neither flashy nor funny, her performance is sometimes underappreciated, which is a shame, because it's actually pitch perfect. She never once overacted or reached for something that wasn't there. All of the action revolves around her character, and it was her job to capture that sense of innocence and helplessness, and she did it beautifully. Some actors frequently stumble through scenes and sometimes require a couple of takes to get it right. Not Robin. As I recall, she nailed just about every scene on the first take. She was flawless, the perfect choice to play Buttercup.
Wallace Shawn.
I was impressed by how hard a worker she was. Not to be self-pitying about actors, I mean, obviously, being in a movie is easier than being a coal miner, but she was incredibly hard-working and disciplined, and, you know, she was clearly in a foreign country and surrounded by these fast-talking, very vivacious people, many of whom, in a way, shared an East Coast, vaguely Jewish show business vocabulary that she didn't really know. And she just did her job and was great.
I fell in love with Robin from the moment we met, as indeed did nearly everyone who either met her or got to know her. She is a remarkable woman and a great talent to work with. All I recall is that we had a really fun time working together on the film, with myself as a pirate and she as a fair maiden, running off together in the spirit of love and adventure. I mean, honestly, how much more fun can you have than that?
Robin Wright.
I was smitten with Carrie, so obviously that helped with our on-screen chemistry, and we also really enjoyed each other. We made each other laugh constantly. And he is still, always will be, hilariously funny.
I like to think that the chemistry between us translated onto the screen. I've already told you how much fun she is just to hang with. But she also brings that same sense of fun and joy to the set and can light up any room with her smile. She is so genuinely relaxed and comfortable in her own skin and is also very focused at the same time. Getting to play her knight in shining armor on screen also made me feel very protective of her off screen. Not that Robin couldn't handle herself in any situation. In fact, I think it's safe to say that everyone felt protective of Robin. I know there's a very famous story that has now actually been made into a cartoon, where Robin was really beginning to feel the cold chill on the Derbyshire moors while shooting her kidnapped scenes with Mandy, Andre, and Wally. And she began to get the shivers. And once you get the shivers, it's very hard to stop your teeth from chattering. So Andre, sweetheart of a man that he was, devised a technique to keep her warm that was very simple, really. He would use one of his hands as a hat on top of Robin's head. She said it was like having a giant hot water bottle up there. It certainly did the trick, and he didn't even mess up her hair that much. In the years since we made the movie, the industry has acknowledged what those of us who knew her back then already realized, that she is an extraordinary actor. And she seems to only be getting better with time, something that can be said about very few actors. As I write this now, she is just a few weeks removed from her triumph at the Golden Globes, where she received the award for Best Performance by an Actress in a Leading Role for her remarkable work as the devious and scheming Claire Underwood on the Netflix series House of Cards. In every role, she gives something of herself that's unique. She never holds back and has that rare ability to tap into something deeply profound within herself that is appropriate for the character. She is a very observant and intelligent woman, which is why she is a marvel to watch, and I am proud to call her a friend.
Robin Wright.
It doesn't matter how many years go by, I think there's a bond that we all have from that experience that will never fade.
Chapter 9, Vincini and Miracle Max. One of the great things about working on The Princess Bride was having an opportunity to perform alongside some of the smartest and most gifted comedic talents in the business. Just about everyone in the film had a chance to show off their comic chops, but I think two performances in particular are generally regarded as among the funniest in the movie. The first is that of Wallace Shawn in the role of the Sicilian Vincini. I knew Wally from My Dinner with Andre, directed by the great Louis Malle, in which he was both the co-star and the screenwriter. The film contains some of my favorite lines, many of which are perhaps very revealing and personal from Wally's standpoint. For example, when he says,
"That's what scares us. That moment of being face to face with another person. I mean, you wouldn't think it would be so frightening."
Wally, I should point out, is one of the nicest guys you'll ever meet. The kind of mild-mannered, amiable, polite guy who still uses words like gosh and gee as part of his speech. And he truly does have a dizzying intellect, having graduated with a BA in history from Harvard and studied economics and philosophy at Oxford. Which is hardly surprising, since both his parents were journalists for The New Yorker, his father eventually becoming the editor of that magazine for 35 years and a very close friend of J.D. Salinger. After college, Wally had originally intended to become a diplomat, but instead opted to travel to India as an English teacher on a Fulbright scholarship. While we were shooting at Shepperton, he and his longtime partner, Deborah Eisenberg, another brilliant writer, actor, and professor, invited Rob, Andy, and the whole cast over to the apartment they had rented near Sloane Square in London for drinks one evening. I recall being impressed by the remarkable library in the study, and Wally telling me that it was one of the main reasons he picked the place. He also told me that during his time off, he was going to give a lecture at Oxford on English and American literature, something that prominent universities around the world, not surprisingly, paid him handsomely to do. Still, none of Wally's dizzying intellect as a writer, philosopher, or literature professor could dispel his insecurities as an actor. And even though I obviously do not possess anything close to his level of intelligence, it was something I could easily relate to myself.
William Goldman. I remember being at the casting session for Vizzini with Rob and about 5 or 6 other people, and the door opens and Wally Shawn walks in. He took one look at us all and said, "Oh my," and then turned around and walked right back out again. We had no idea what was going on. Finally, he was persuaded to come back in and read, and he was terrific.
I may be no dolt, but in a real battle of wits, I'm hardly a worthy match for Wallace Shawn. Frankly, I don't think many people are.
Wallace Shawn.
Carrie is this good-hearted, lovely, fairy tale character. And that's what the movie's supposed to be about, in a way. So there was always something outrageously lovable about him, during the filming itself and up to this day. He's just a genuinely good-hearted person. And he was fantastically hard-working during the shoot.
And the reason for his uncertainty? It wasn't a case of the first day heebie-jeebies that I had suffered, but a real fear that he was going to be replaced. Apparently, Wally had heard from somewhere that Rob had wanted another actor to play the role of Vincini, and the rumors left him with something of an inferiority complex, as well as a near crippling case of the jitters during production.
Wallace Shawn.
I knew I was wrong for the part because, for whatever reason, I'd been informed by someone in my agency that it had first been offered to Danny DeVito and then to Richard Dreyfuss, and that they'd both turned down the part. The character, obviously, is Vizzini, and I knew that Danny comes from an Italian background and I'm from a Jewish background. But that was the least of my concerns. My greater concern was that I knew that Danny would understand the sense of humor that was called for by the script and would have done such a beautiful job. And before every single shot of the film, I imagined how Danny would have played it so much better than I could. I was haunted by that during every single shot of the film. So if any agents are listening to this, my advice to them is, don't tell your client that he's the third choice.
I remember him being a veritable bundle of nerves from day one, starting with the table read, all the way through to his final day of shooting. He told me later that every time Rob yelled cut after one of his takes, he felt for sure he was about to be fired.
Rob Reiner.
Wally was funny. The first day, he messed up a bunch of takes, and he kept thinking that I was going to fire him or something. I never even thought about that. Never considered it. But in his mind, that's what I was going to do. He kept saying to me, "I don't really have a Sicilian accent." I said, "That's okay, Wally. This Sicilian talks just like you. He talks exactly like you." And he did exactly what I wanted him to do, and he was great.
Christopher Guest.
I remember I had dinner with Wally in Sheffield, and he kept saying, "Chris, this just isn't going to work. Rob's going to send me home. This isn't going to be good." And I said, no, it's fantastic. What are you talking about?"
Andy Scheinman.
He kept saying to me, "I'm going to get fired. You're going to fire me." And I'd say, "We're not going to fire you, Wally." I didn't realize it at the time, but he later said he had no understanding of the comedy of this movie. He wrote something once about the experience and how miserable he was on a particular day or in a particular scene. Wally is a highly respected playwright, but he was amazed that what he did in this movie is, as he said in his own words, 1,000 times more loved and respected than anything else he had ever done in his career. It's such a weird thing, because to this day, I don't think he quite gets why it's so good.
I don't know whether his anxieties were based on fact or fiction. I do know that both Rob and Andy have said over the years that they never seriously pursued any other actors for the role, and that they love his performance, just as we all do. Rob told me he was not only an enormous fan of Wally's, but even fought on his behalf to have him in the movie.
Wallace Shawn.
To be honest, I didn't think Rob was very pleased with me. I mean, he never said anything like, "You're fantastic in this part, it's going to change your life, you're wonderful in the role." Nothing of that nature. I think he may have been pleased by the time the whole movie was put together and edited. I really wouldn't know. But I think that at least at first he may have been thinking, well, he's okay, but I wish Danny were here. Let me put it this way. I know that Billy Crystal and Carol Kane spoke about how Rob laughed so hysterically during their scenes that he had to leave the room. That didn't happen during my scenes.
Rob also did everything in his power to calm Wally and to coax what surely will be remembered as one of his most memorable performances. Much of the credit, and this is true of any of us, fortunate to have been cast in The Princess Bride, should rightfully go to Goldman, who scripted the countless quotable lines of which Vincini was given more than his fair share. But Wally deserves recognition, too, for the unmistakable stamp he put on the character and the unique manner in which he delivered those lines. A diminutive Jewish man from New York playing a tyrannical Sicilian crime boss? Inconceivable, you say? And yet how perfectly it all worked. In hindsight, one cannot envision anyone else in the role. But there were some interesting and tension-filled moments when it seemed uncertain whether Wally would survive the production. We began filming our only scene together, known affectionately as the Iocane powder scene, or more appropriately, as the Battle of Wits scene, in mid-September at a place called Lathkill Dale, a beautiful river valley in the Peak District. Wally, bless him, was demonstrably nervous, which actually helped me a bit, since I was completely in awe of him at the time. Granted, I had only seen one of his movies, but that was enough for me. The minute he walked onto the set, in his beautiful, ornate red and green velvet outfit, he looked like a wonderful prince from a Florentine fresco. Phyllis Dalton had even designed a matching hat for him, a flat medieval cap with a great big red feather sticking out of it. Wally tried it on once, quickly looked at all of our faces to gauge our reactions, and decided not to wear it. With apologies to Phyllis, it was probably a wise decision, as it might have been overkill. As we began rehearsing the scene, I had no notion of Wally's insecurity, but I did notice he was sweating quite a lot, which struck me as odd because it was a rather chilly and overcast morning. Perhaps it was the heavy velvet doublet he was wearing, I thought. But as we continued to run the lines, his anxiety and perspiration became more apparent. At first, I couldn't understand it. Here was this man, always the smartest in the room, experienced and lauded for his stage and screen work, concerned about a funny little scene in a fairy tale movie. It didn't make sense. It wasn't until many years later, when Wally would reveal what was in his head that day, that it all made sense. Even now, I feel for Wally, because the schedule required him to film his most difficult scene, and without a doubt the most loquacious one in the entire movie, as his first moment in front of the camera. If you've only seen The Princess Bride once or twice, or haven't seen it in many years, the Battle of Wits scene is the one with the long, complicated passages of dialogue between the man in black and Vincini as they try to outwit each other and trick their opponent into drinking a glass of wine dosed with iocane powder, which is odorless, tasteless, dissolves instantly in liquid, and is among the deadlier poisons known to man. By the way, if you're wondering whether iocane really exists, it does not, except in the fertile imagination of Mr. William Goldman. It might feel, in retrospect, as though Wesley and Vincini are burdened with equal amounts of tongue-twisting, mind-bending dialogue, but that actually is not the case. Not by a long shot.
Rob Reiner.
It's true Wally had the most difficult sequence in the movie. The Battle of Wits was very difficult, but you know, I've heard from Wally and from other people who've told me the same thing, that a day doesn't go by when somebody doesn't say to him, "Inconceivable!" or just ask him to say, "Inconceivable!"
Robin Wright.
Oh, he was nervous. He had a lot of lines to memorize, and Rob wanted him to recite it very fast. I think he was petrified of getting fired.
Wallace Shawn.
Here's another piece of advice that I'm going to give to any filmmaker who happens to be listening. It's not always kind to the actor to make his most difficult scene be the first scene that he does. That can be very, very hard. It takes a few days or maybe a week to get into the mood of a movie and to get to feel comfortable with being in the movie and with the other actors and the crew and to recognize everyone's faces and so on. So to suddenly have to do your hardest scene on the very first day is not desirable. But obviously, scheduling a complex film sometimes means that the first day is the only day that it could be shot. And that's what happened to me. Actually, we shot it over 2 days, and the ghost of Danny DeVito was devastatingly present the whole time.
Whereas Wally did all the heavy lifting in the scene, my job was fairly simple: to sit there and react to his character's histrionics. A subtle nod here, a slight wave of the hand there. One line of dialogue to every 5 or 6 lines spoken by Wally. In the scene, the man in black figures that Vincini is too clever by half, and that he will ultimately tie himself into knots trying to outwit his opponent. And that is precisely what happens.
Wallace Shawn.
At my request, Rob acted out the part. Before I would do a section of it, I would ask him to do it for me. Then I would try to imitate what he had done. So you could say that what you see on screen is a kind of collaboration. It's 40% me, 40% Rob Reiner, and 20% Danny DeVito. Because I was obviously in some way imagining what Danny might have done, although I knew I had to be me, not him, and I was trying to be me, or at least to be Rob, and not Danny. Anyway, a lot of what I did was totally Rob's idea. For example, the way the scene ends, where I sort of fall over sideways dead? I would never have done that. It was totally Rob's idea.
Even though Wally was unconvinced of his talent in being able to pull off Vincini, it's a beautifully crafted performance, and it anchors the most hilariously convoluted scene in the movie. It is both perfect and timeless, even though it was stressful for him. Equally stressful for Wally was his work on and around the infamous Cliffs of Insanity. The exterior shots of this sequence, where the man in black chases Buttercup's kidnappers up a cliff, were actually filmed on the massive Cliffs of Moher in Ireland, using stunt doubles, filmed from a great distance, to obscure the fact that it wasn't really me racing up the side of a sheer rock face, and that Andre wasn't really carrying Wally, Robin, and Mandy as he hoisted himself up. The effect was achieved by using a massive crane and pulleys to yank the stuntmen up the side of the cliffs. It's kind of funny to look at the film now, the way it's so obviously not Andre pulling himself up, but rather Peter Diamond wearing a bulky suit and a rubber physic mask strapped to a harness. And the speed at which the man in black scales the cliff. It doesn't really matter, though. In hindsight, it all somehow seems charming, much like the rodents of unusual size. Our actual climbing sequences were filmed in comparative safety on the same soundstage at Shepperton where the duel would take place, with man-made cliffs that stood only 30 feet high. I wore a safety harness and was either reeled in effortlessly by a pulley or actually fastened to the plaster cliff for the dialogue, so it wasn't like I had to do any actual climbing. There were, however, obstacles to overcome for Wally's team. For one thing, Andre's bad back precluded him from actually carrying anyone or from being hoisted in the harness. So the crew devised a system in which Andre could stand on a platform attached to a forklift and hold on to Wally, while Robin and Mandy sat on modified bicycle seats next to them. All would appear perfectly safe and sound, except for one thing. Wally was terrified of heights.
Wallace Shawn.
I don't like heights. And I remember at my audition, I asked Rob and Andy, are we really going to be on the world's tallest cliffs or what? We're not really going to have to do all of those things, are we? All those stunts? And they said, no, that'll all be done by stuntmen. Which was only partly true, because although we didn't go to the world's tallest cliffs, we were obliged to act on a small forklift that, in my memory, couldn't have been more than 4 or 5 feet square, 35 feet up in the air on a sound stage at Shepperton. And even that was mind-bogglingly frightening to me. I would never have taken the part if I'd known we were going to have to do that.
While 30 feet of stucco and plaster might seem safe and surmountable when compared to the breathtaking 390-foot cliffs of Moor, to Wally, the prospect of scaling even a 10-foot wall seemed, well, inconceivable. I'm sure he didn't want to tell Rob too early in the production, in case he might provide the director with another excuse to replace him. Once again, though, he overcame his fears and turned in an epic performance. In reality, it was also Andre's compassion and protective nature that helped calm Wally's acrophobia. In many ways, Andre really was like Fezzik, a gentle giant.
Mandy Patinkin. Wally was terrified of heights, and he was worried that he was going to ruin the whole scene. There was even a double for him on the set, just in case. But he stepped up to the plate, got on that forklift, and hung on to Andre for dear life. And Andre just patted him like a little kid and said, "Don't worry, I'll take care of you." I'll never forget it. The moment Andre said that to Wally, Wally calmed down and stopped feeling anxious. Then he just played the scene beautifully. And it was because of Andre's gentle assurances that Wally was able to even breathe. Wallace Shawn.
Andre was very kind that day. I was physically tied to him during the part of the film that was the most terrifying to me. He had a flask of cognac in his costume that he offered me. I declined because it was sort of dizzying up there anyway. And Rob was very kind also. He realized how panicked I was, so he shot the film in a way that minimized the need for me to be up there. So he actually gave up some very good shots out of kindness to me, which is a very unusual and remarkable thing for a director to do.
Wally may have had some of the movie's most quotable lines, but if you were to stop people on the street and ask them to name a character in The Princess Bride besides Buttercup and Wesley, I would be willing to bet that a great majority would respond first with Miracle Max. This is surprising, given that Billy Crystal, who played Max, was on the set for all of about 3 days and appeared in just a single scene that spanned less than 5 minutes on film. It is also perfectly understandable, given that this scene is one of the funniest in the movie. In fact, it is so funny and strange, and the tenor so unique, that it almost feels like it was dropped in from another screenplay. But it wasn't, of course. Miracle Max is Bill Goldman's creation, albeit one supplemented by Billy's comedic talent. We were 2 months into production by the time Billy and his on-screen wife, Carol Kane, arrived on the set on October 15th. I had just finished another training session with Peter Diamond when I ran into Rob, who informed me that Billy had arrived. "Can I go say hi?" I asked. "Yeah, sure," Rob said. "He's in makeup." For a moment, I wondered if I would experience the unease that comes with meeting someone whose work you've long admired. As an actor, if you hang around Hollywood long enough, and if you're lucky, you may get a chance to meet some of your idols. Sometimes it's disappointing. Sometimes it's exactly what you hope it'll be. Billy was every bit as funny and charming as I had imagined. He is an extremely down-to-earth person, yet seemingly incapable of not cracking jokes and generally just trying to make people smile. Some stand-up comics, and some comic actors, Billy is both, are totally different people offstage than they are onstage. Billy is the same person regardless of his surroundings. He is genuinely funny and genuinely nice all of the time. As I entered the makeup department, I found him sitting in a chair, patiently allowing his longtime makeup artist, Peter Montagna, to go about the painstaking task of transforming the 39-year-old actor into an ancient and cranky troll-like wizard. We made small talk for a few minutes, with Billy grilling me about how the movie was going and saying how excited he was to be a part of it. Fascinated with his transformation, I asked him how he came up with the look for Max, and I remember him telling me how he wanted him to be a cross between Casey Stengel and his grandmother.
Billy Crystal.
I was in and out in 3 days. I played Miracle Max, of course, and I designed the makeup with Peter Montagna, and I said, "Peter, I want to look like a combination of Casey Stengel and my grandmother." And that's what we did. brilliant piece of makeup. I was 5 hours in the chair. We got to Shepperton Studios around 2 o'clock in the morning, and at 7 o'clock, I was a cranky old Jewish guy.
Then, as Peter began applying the last pieces of wrinkled latex to his face, Billy began reciting lines of dialogue from the script, searching for Max's character as he stared in the mirror. He even began improvising all these crazy impersonations of everyone who would end up influencing the role. It was absolutely hilarious. I felt like I was being treated to a private screening of a one-man show. I realized at that moment that The Princess Bride was not only going to be a good movie, it had a shot at being a commercially successful one as well. I'd initially thought it was such an unusual movie that it was impossible to gauge whether we had hit the mark, let alone whether there was an audience eager to see it. Billy changed all of that, or at least changed the way I felt about it. He knew exactly what he was going to do with his character. Clearly, Mel Brooks was an inspiration. In fact, in the screenplay, his character is introduced as follows. From inside the hovel, a little man's voice is heard. If Mel Brooks's 2,000-year-old man was really old, he'd resemble this guy.
Billy Crystal.
You know, when Rod asked me to play Miracle Max, I said, why don't you just cast Mel Brooks? And he said, because I want you. It was that simple, and I think in retrospect, it was, for me, you know, the perfect choice, because I just loved playing this guy, and I became him, and Carol Kane became Valerie, and it just made more sense. You know, I think Rob was very conscious of the fact that if Mel Brooks was there, people would go, oh, it's Mel Brooks. And the reality of making a fantasy like this, if you will, was really the challenge. And I'm thrilled that it worked out that way.
Billy wanted Max to be unique in his own right. I'd heard there were issues with an earlier makeup test, that the prosthetics looked too comical, almost distracting. So he and Peter worked together for a while in L.A. before finally agreeing on the look. I watched as Peter applied each new set of prosthetics, occasionally taking a step back to let Billy assess the progress and practice some lines. He'd scrunch up his face, clear an imaginary wad of phlegm from his throat, and shout at his image in the mirror.
What? What? What?
I'll never know whether he was willing the character to life, or perhaps just doing his grandmother. Maybe it was a little of both. Either way, it was funny. By the time Peter had finally applied the last pieces of Billy's makeup, the wig and contact lenses, Billy had actually become Miracle Max. He was this other guy, this crotchety old man, completely transformed, hilarious. And once he was on the set in full makeup, he stayed in character.
Billy Crystal.
The funny thing about doing a movie was also, you know, once you're in the makeup, you're in the makeup, and you can't take it off. So we would go to lunch, and this Carol and I, and we look like two apple sculptures. And there's Mandy with the crazy hair. And Chris came. So we have a six-fingered guy, me, and Rob, and Carrie. And we'd sit down for lunch in a commissary. And when you've got the stuff on your face, you can't really, like, be out of character. So waitress would come over, and I'd order like him. Miss, how is the shepherd's pie? Is it spicy? Am I going to regret this in the morning? And she would be like, no, sir, I think it's quite lovely. And I'd say, drop the accent. You're from the Bronx. I know it. We had a lot of fun. I would just tease them constantly. You sure it's not spicy? Because I know my colon. And if my colon gets upset, it's not good for anybody.
I was also introduced to Carol Kane on that day. I was a huge fan of her work. Besides her performance in Dog Day Afternoon, I had also been in awe of her portrayal of Andy Kaufman's wife, Simca Dablitz-Gravis, in Taxi, and her roles in Carnal Knowledge, Annie Hall, and The Last Detail. Here was an actress whose incredible body of work spanned more than a decade, coming in to do a cameo in our movie. And while Billy's is the flashier role and the performance people seem to recall most vividly, Carol's work was also outstanding, and her transformation even more intense.
Christopher Guest.
You had these two people, Billy and Carol, made up to look like they were 2,000 years old, and there was definitely some giggling going on. I mean, the scene is almost a separate part of the movie. It has its own style.
Billy Crystal.
It was a perfect little beauty, 3 days in, 3 days out, and you score big, that's a cameo.
Today, you can look at Miracle Max, and you can see and hear Billy's voice, but Carol is virtually unrecognizable as Max's shrieking wife, Valerie. She is described in the script as an ancient fury, and she was indeed ferocious in the role, but ancient? Hardly. People don't realize that she was only 34 at the time. With each introduction of a new cast member, I felt more and more like a kid at theater camp who has been suddenly plucked from the ranks of the ordinary and tossed onto a Broadway stage. With Billy and Carol, the effect was intensified by two factors, the sheer amount of makeup and prosthetics, and the fact that they arrived so deep into the production and stayed for such a short amount of time. To be honest, I rarely saw either one of them when they weren't disguised as Miracle Max and Valerie. And it could not have been comfortable, slogging around for 12, 14 hours in thick makeup, wearing heavy burlap costumes, and toiling under hot lights. Norman Garwood had designed a magnificent little cabin in a fake forest to serve as their home. It looked perfect, but man, was it hot in there once all the lights were switched on. Not that Billy or Carol seemed even slightly distracted by any of that. Both of them brought their A-game, so to speak, and in so doing, created not only one of the most recognizable scenes in the movie, but some of the most memorable days of filming.
Carol Kane.
What I remember first off about Carrie is that certain kind of nobility that he has, and that mixed in with an extremely impish sense of humor, which is a very rare sort of combo, because sometimes when a young man or young woman is that extraordinarily beautiful, they don't rely much on their sense of humor. But I think that when you crack the nut open, that's the delicious part inside of Carrie.
All I recall from those 3 days of shooting in Miracle Max's cabin is that they were days filled with insane laughter. Rob said he wanted the scene to be outrageous, so he basically gave Billy free license to run with the character. Not that Billy needed much prodding. From the very first shot, in which Cantankerous Max appears, poking his head through a wooden peephole in the door, very much like the doorman who greets Dorothy when she and her friends reach Oz, he began ad-libbing. For 3 straight days and 10 hours a day, Billy improvised 13th-century period jokes, never saying the same thing or the same line twice. Such was the hilarity of his ad-libbing that he actually caused Mandy to injure himself while fighting to suppress the need to laugh. Therefore, you can only imagine what it did to me and to Rob, who had to leave the set because his boisterous laugh was ruining too many early takes.
Mandy Patinkin. It was one of the most joyous times, certainly, of my life. I can only speak for myself, but one wondered why we were getting paid and not paying them. The only injury I sustained in the film was off camera, when I was delivering lines to Billy Crystal in the Miracle Max scene. Carrie was dead on the table, Andre was there, and I was off camera standing next to Rob, giving Billy his cue lines. And Rob couldn't take it. He was laughing on every take. He didn't want it on the soundtrack, so he had to leave the set after he called action. And I was stuck there having to hold it together while feeding Billy his lines. I literally bruised a rib from holding in my laughter. That's the only injury I got on the whole film. And as I'm sure you well know, we did all the stunts ourselves.
Some of the improvs made it into the film. For example, when Max opens the peep door, the original script called for him to say merely,
"The king's stinking son fired me,"
in response to Indigo asking whether he is the same Miracle Max who worked for the king all those years. To better illustrate his character's bitterness towards the king, Billy decided to add the line,
"And thank you so much for bringing up such a painful subject. While you're at it, why don't you give me a nice paper cut and pour lemon juice on it?"
He also came up with the twisted notion of rating true love on a scale of the most important things in life with a sandwich.
"Sonny, true love is the greatest thing in the world, except for a nice MLT. Mutton lettuce tomato sandwich, where the mutton is nice and lean and the tomato is ripe."
A quote that has since followed him in some form or variation into every deli and restaurant for the rest of his life. Some of the funniest takes were just too blue, which is why they ended up on the cutting room floor. After all, The Princess Bride is a family-friendly PG film, meant to be appropriate and enjoyable for viewers of nearly all ages. So as you can imagine, we really couldn't have Max comparing true love to a vigorous bowel movement, funny though it was. Nor could you have him explain his foul mood by saying,
"Don't rush me, sonny. I had a difficult night last night. I found my nephew with a sheep."
Which couldn't have been used anyway, since the entire crew, and especially Rob, lost it after he delivered the line. In fact, these lines, and countless others, led to unusable takes ruined by all of us giggling. And if you go to YouTube to find the outtakes, you can hear us all cracking up. For those of us who had never worked with him before, we realized that all Billy needs is a receptive audience, and there is just no stopping him.
Billy Crystal.
I mean, how could you not have fun in that little scene, that great little set? I got a mostly dead guy laying down who couldn't talk, so right away I have an advantage. You have a 7'6" guy, a giant, Mandy, and lovely Carol, and a director who loved to laugh. The only problem with Rob is he laughs too loud, so sometimes he would actually ruin takes. He had us like standoff in the middle of the forest where we would do our scene. We'd yell at him, "Get off the set, get off." And he would just let me play and find things. And he said, "Listen, we got the scene. Now have fun. Go have fun." And that's when fun things happened, like the mutton, lettuce, and tomato run that I did. True love is the greatest thing in the world except for an MLT. That was all made up on the spot. And that's because you're with perfect material, great actors, and an amazing director.
In some ways, I had the most difficult task of all, as I had to present the illusion of someone who is supposed to be mostly dead. Rob told me that I could not move at all, not even a twitch. I wasn't even supposed to look like I was breathing, let alone laughing, as the camera would be able to see my chest moving. But the insanity of trying not to laugh while Billy was doing his ancient Yiddish stand-up would prove impossible even for me. I think he was actually trying to make me crack up during my one line in the scene where he pushes air out of my stomach. And guess what? He succeeded. I just couldn't do it. After I had botched a number of takes, the decision was made to replace me on the table with a rubber dummy that Andre had been carrying around. I had to join Rob at a monitor set up in the hallway outside the soundstage, where we had both now been banished by the sound department for laughing too much. And it should also be noted that Carol truly enhanced the magic of all her moments with her improvising as well.
Carol Kane.
There are so many opportunities for anything to fall apart that hopefully you can take real joy in the process, because that's all you have. Anything else is just some extra added incredible bonus. What I took away with me was that this process was just twinkling in some way, that this group of people that I was in that room with, each and every one of them, were so extraordinary and so extraordinarily well cast that each day was delicious and valuable, and I was very grateful. I think that's the odd thing about the movie. We all felt that way.
She created the whole bit with Billy regarding the chocolate-covered pill, bringing it to a level of hilarity that stands up to this day, offering helpful tips regarding ingestion and dosage. Valerie.
The chocolate coating makes it go down easier, but you have to wait 15 minutes for full potency, and you shouldn't go in swimming after for at least what? An hour. Yeah, a good hour.
Carol Kane.
I think my first day of shooting, the makeup took something like 9 hours. So I was sitting up in this chair, and they were shooting already and doing the parts of the scene that I'm not in. It was very frightening for me because they had all been working together for several hours before I was allowed out of the makeup chair. But then, it was just so much fun. And, you know, certain things were improvised, like the thing about the chocolate. But, of course, Billy is the master at that, the absolute master. It was almost impossible not to laugh.
Billy Crystal.
The most freeing thing for any actor is having a director that trusts him and material that's sort of perfect to begin with.
I have found that some of the most famous lines from the movie are quoted not only when people are thinking or talking about The Princess Bride, but also when they find themselves in circumstances entirely at odds with the whimsical tone of the film. My favorite story about this involves a man and his son whom I met while I was filming a movie in Rochester, New York. The father told me how the movie had actually saved him from going insane. I always have time for fans, but this guy definitely piqued my interest. How, if you don't mind my asking? He proceeded to explain that he had been on active duty in the military and had recently returned from a long deployment in Iraq. His base had been located in a highly dangerous area. There were lots of snipers, IEDs, and mortar fire, he told me, and after losing a lot of his comrades, morale among the unit had sunk to an all-time low. So, every night, from that point on, before the soldiers went out in their Humvees to secure the perimeter or go out on patrol, their commanding officer would give them their orders and send them on their way with these words: "Have fun storming the castle." Thanks to your movie, we were all able to complete our mission on that base, as our CO was able to always make us smile before heading out, and that did a lot for morale. I was very moved by his story. I guess you just never know how your work can affect people. The only two actors from Rob's traveling circus I didn't get to spend a lot of time with were Peter Falk and Fred Savage. The scenes between Fred as the sickly grandson being read to by his grandfather, played by Peter, were shot just a few doors down on L stage, long after most of us had wrapped the movie. And although I never got to work with them or even watch their scenes, I just want to acknowledge just how marvelous I think they both are in the movie. I was not aware of Fred's talent at the time, but had of course caught many episodes of Columbo as a kid. Their moments together really anchor the whole movie, and they are played with such loving tenderness that, for me, they are some of the most moving ones in the film. Falk, incidentally enough, was concerned that he wasn't actually old enough to play the part of the grandfather convincingly, being 59 at the time. And he apparently arranged for the makeup department to put prosthetics on his face to make him look older. But after he saw the dailies, he turned to Rob and said he thought he looked like a burn victim.
Fred Savage: I remember Peter was in older makeup and he felt like it made him look too old. So we had to shoot it again with different makeup to make him look younger. He was so wonderful. No one was kinder and more patient and made me feel more comfortable than Peter. Honestly, I don't even remember when we were shooting or when we weren't shooting. He would sit in that chair and I would be in that bed and he would talk to me all day. I grew very fond of him. Over the years, he and I remained in contact. I had great affection for him. I was so devastated, as so many people were, when he passed away. That's what I remember more than anything: Peter and his warmth. I forgot all about acting or even shooting a movie. He just kind of became my grandfather.
Chapter 10: A Couple of Mishaps. Filmmaking is not an inherently risky business, especially for those of us fortunate enough to be working in front of the camera. And, unless you are Tom Cruise, it is usually stuntmen and women who handle the vast majority of tasks that could, by any stretch of the imagination, be considered dangerous. And even then, every precaution is taken to ensure the safety and health of everyone concerned. That is why there are safety meetings, where the first AD and the stunt coordinator explain the stunts to the cast and crew and how to keep them and anyone else from getting injured. That said, if you are young and reckless enough, you can probably find a way to get banged up in the course of filming a movie, which is precisely what happened to me on the set of The Princess Bride. Twice, in fact, although in the interest of full disclosure, I should point out that only one of the injuries was incurred while I was actually working. The first injury happened while I was simply behaving like someone whose sense of adventure exceeded his aptitude. It happened in late September, while we were shooting the scene where the man in black taunts Buttercup about her true love for the farm boy, with the line, "Life is pain, Highness. Anyone who says differently is selling something." Another priceless Goldman gem. Little did I know that I would experience true agonizing pain only moments before I could deliver the line. Moreover, I would be the one trying to sell something different just to cover my butt. The spot that Rob chose to shoot this sequence was high up on a hilltop above a sheer ravine in a place called Cave Dale in Derbyshire. Andre happened to be there as he was practicing with his stunt double, Terry Richards, for our fight scene later on. Early in the shoot,